So we'll open it up to questions from the floor. There's a microphone here, so could you come up to the mic? I think it'll facilitate everyone hearing you better.
Hello, thank you very much for all of your presentations. I'm David Pereka from the Faculty Association at the University of Waterloo. I have a comment or an observation to make, first of all, that there's a good reason to think that there's no such thing as sustainable growth, that on a finite planet that just doesn't make sense, and that in fact we now live in a full world. And in light of these two observations, what if aggregate economic growth is now over because of increasing energy costs and declining availability? And what does that observation, what impact does that observation have on all of your comments?
Would like to take that?
Well, I'll start because I was talking about the importance of growth and job creation as the solution to the deficit. I'm sympathetic to your issue about your focus, quite right, in terms of the need for sustainability. I think some of the issue is around terminology. When I say growth, I don't necessarily mean, you know, more mines, more resource extraction, more pollution. When I say growth, I ultimately mean more work. Growth includes putting more people to work in universities, okay? And I would see that as an environmentally benign activity and a socially beneficial activity and one that generates income. Well, other than the spewing of bullshit that goes on, of course, there's kinds of growth that are actually good for the environment. If we're investing in public transit and green energy and ameliorating pollution, then that is growth too. So I am increasingly tired of the growth versus the environment debate. I think that's the wrong way to phrase it. I think the goal is not growth. The goal is putting people back to work doing stuff that's needed, including taking care of the environment, and that will generate the incomes that we will support our taxes, that will pay for our services.
That's a really good answer. That's a really good answer. I would only add, I think it's a really good answer, but I also think it's a really good question. The sort of the glib phrase of sustainable development, sustainable growth, has allowed people to say, yes, we can become greener, richer, fairer all at the same time with no trade-offs. And while I agree with what Jim says, that you can have growth that is truly green, there are trade-offs. That if we're serious about sustainability, there will be a cost to the GDP in the short term. And if in the long term Jim is right, that we can find the balance, we have to stop pretending that in order to pay forward our obligations to future generations for this planet, there will be a cost, and it's the cost we'd be willing to pay. One of the difficulties of the neoliberal frame, which is focuses on our individual actions in the market, is that we've lost a sense of the common good and the notion that there might be some good important enough that we would compromise our own private interests. I believe that asking the question that you've put, I believe that the tension between them isn't entirely one or the other, but there is a tension between them, and it's a discussion that we won't have in Canada, but we need. So I'm glad you asked the question.
Another question?
I'm Judy Bates. I'm from Wilfrid Laurier Faculty Association. I'm interested, Jim, you've commented on many occasions about this issue of idle money as being one of the major contributing factors to our current problems. And I'm wondering the extent to which you feel that we can reverse that situation and actually get these corporations to use that idle money to create jobs, and what we need to do to do that, to achieve that.
Great. That's a great question. Thank you. Idle money, or dead money, as Mark Carney famously called it, speaking to the CAW convention, I might add. The problem here is what is actually, I think, a better term is excess corporate savings. Corporations, even though the economy is not in great shape, are receiving very strong after-tax cash flow, partly because society has been remade over the last quarter century in a way that benefits their position, so the pre-tax profit flow is strong, even though the economy is not great. And then secondly, it's been reinforced by the corporate tax cuts that have been very substantial, dating back, as Alex said, to 2000 and continuing even recently. Now, if, in fact, companies were taking that after-tax cash flow and pumping it back into capital programs that created work at home, then we could see some benefits from that. But the response of business investment to the cash flow and to the tax cuts has been, by and large, disappointing. So the result is a accumulation of idle cash or dead money, but it's worse than that. It's also money that's paid out in excess of dividends It's money that the companies channel into financial speculation and money that the companies invest, but they don't invest here, they invest somewhere else. So that's where I think we need a strategy to put idle money into action, and that can include ways to try and stimulate business investment. I think that across the board tax cuts have not been successful in that regard. I'm more supportive of measures like accelerated depreciation, which in order to get the benefit, the company has to spend the money first. I think focused sector strategies in certain areas, not just auto and steel and the traditional manufacturing sectors, but new sectors that are going to be important in international trade and R&D and so on, can be valuable. I also think that we have to look at public investment as a way of filling in the gap that's left by inadequate business investment. I don't see any fundamental difference between a public sector agency investing in long-run productive capital and borrowing to do it than what private businesses do as well. But there's a lot of discussion and research that needs to be done to put together a case that will be comprehensive and credible around that.
I might just add just one other issue. I agree with all that, but my sense is that nothing drives corporate spending more than the desire to avoid taxes. If we had a carbon tax, you would really spur some innovation to reduce your carbon output. And think of the multiple, now you're going to use the cash for innovation, but think of the multiple benefits that would flow from putting a price on carbon.
I think that, just briefly, I think you'll see the cash. I think you'll see it come back to get put to work. It shouldn't be forgotten that the events of the financial markets in 2008-2009 were sort of the equivalent of a 1-in-50-year flood. And a lot of companies found themselves either with no access to money at the time or with very expensive access to money. And so there is some of the sort of quote-unquote dead money problem is really just a reaction to that. I'm chief financial officer of company X, and when 2009 rolled around, if I didn't have cash, there was some question about whether I was going to make payroll. So that was, if you will, a scarring event for business communities, for the business community, and also for companies that that require sort of access to the capital markets to do their operations. So I think you'll see more investment as confidence comes back that we're not going into another recession. You'll see some of those companies pay out that money in dividends, which will be good for the economy because it will go to shareholders and pension funds and so on, who can then redeploy it. Because there's not really a lot of reason why corporations want to sit on billions of dollars earning 1%. It doesn't really make sense unless you fear that you might need that money because there's going to be another crisis down the road.
Okay, thanks. Any other questions?
Hi, my name is Kayla Kennedy, and I work for the Canadian Federation of Students Ontario. And as a woman and as a young person, I have a lot of concerns about an austerity agenda. Because we haven't been talking a lot about today about what the impact of cuts today will have on people like me, who, as someone who's 25, just has a university education, and has worked until recently on contract, freelance, been on EI, and that's the reality for I think most of my peers. And when we look forward, when we see cuts to public service jobs in the public sector, when we see wage freezes in both the public and private sector, those wage freezes, sure, they impact the workers right now, but they also impact what I will make in 15 years in a way that they don't impact the people who have taken those wage freezes, who might be retiring or who might be leaving the workforce. And I'm not saying that to say that that they should be taking, I'm not saying that to say that they're not thinking about their own interests or that they're not impacted by those wage freezes, but just that, when workers take concessions right now and are forced to take concessions by employers or by the government, those are going to impact the young people who are going into those professions in a longer way.
Do you have a question there?
Yeah.
A question coming up?
So I just wanted to ask the panelists to comment on, what are we doing in terms of when we employ an austerity agenda today, what are we saying and what are we doing for the youth, for you young people right now in terms of their future, their ability to contribute to society, their ability to contribute to the tax base, and their ability to live decent, dignified lives. So if the panelists could comment on, both the fiscal implications, but also the moral implications of a situation where we're basically saying that previous that the next generation is going to be worse off than generations that came before it.
Who'd like to take that?
Yeah, as a baby boomer, I apologize. I actually think you're right at the heart of one of the real rest points in the future for Canada, and that is intergenerational inequities that are really profound. And the first time in Canadian history that we are thinking, first time in living history, where we imagine that the next generation won't have it as good as we did. And that changes everything. That's a profoundly troubling. We've always assumed that with good effort, our kids would outperform us. We don't think that now. Some people use the debt as a way of talking about intergenerational equity and say, oh, we don't want to pass on the debt. Instead, let's pass on an extraordinary environmental deficit, an extraordinary economic deficit, an extraordinary sense of declinism and fatalism. Well, I'm not sure that's the answer. I think the answer, and one of the reasons why I think there's more room to tax the rich, is that there's an intergenerational equity issue. We're one of the only civilized societies that doesn't have an inheritance tax. Even if you start the inheritance tax of over $3 million, I don't care that it doesn't produce a lot. Let's start looking at how you get at wealth and how you get at the wealth of my generation. We've sucked the planet dry, and we don't want to leave our jobs. So you just wait your turn. So it's time that we look at a tax system that's intergenerationally fair, and that we also pay it forward in terms of a commitment to the environment. We have huge, we take unbelievable joy in how our economy is performing. Well, we have, 14% youth unemployment. So we have to make it a deliberate priority. It's time for my generation to pay it forward. And one of the things, my view of what happened in the streets of Montreal was, of course, the tuition and the privatization of education troubles me. All the centrist punditry think it's inevitable and it's right and it's necessary for the quality of education, as though you couldn't raise taxes and as though this isn't a collective good. And it's my generation that says, let them pay. They're being selfish. Well, we didn't have to. There's something troubling about that. But that was also a reaction to an agenda that doesn't address them. It doesn't address their opportunity or their priorities. And so I think it's absolutely important that we address the intergenerational issue as a matter of public policy, and that my generation has to pay it forward.
Okay, any other questions out there? Would you like to come up to the microphone there? We've got two here.
Hi, Michael Trussello, Mount Royal University. Back in 2011, I released a feature documentary film about the austerity agenda called Capitalism Is the Crisis. As you can imagine, the politics of it are an anti-capitalist response to the austerity agenda. It includes people like Chris Hedges, Leo Panitch, David McNally, a number of other academics and activists speaking to this issue. And the reason I believe this is because I think it's a systemic issue. It's not something that small liberal reforms like tax increases here and there can solve. For example, often in this discussion, what's omitted is the real scale of the theft of public money that went on in the bank bailouts. The last academic study estimated that the value of the bank bailouts from 2007 to 2010 was $29 trillion, which is almost twice the size of the United States GDP. A study from a few months ago said that the super rich have as much as $32 trillion in offshore tax havens. You could go on and on. The LIBOR interest rate scandal, we're talking about scale here. The level of theft that happens under capitalism is not something that can be reformed. It has to be removed. I'm just wondering how I don't see this position, a radical position on the panel here today. And I'm wondering how you can keep the debate in these narrow terms, especially with, sorry, is it Mr. Duclot? Especially from your position, when you can say that there's austerity in the private sector as well as in the public sector. Well, there's no comparison of the two. The OECD says that income disparity in Canada is now at a record high. This was a 2011 report. We've seen for decades now the richest 20% in Canada taking the concentration of new wealth generated. This is just the way that capitalism works, and there's no comparison, therefore, between private sector and public sector austerity. So I guess what I'd like you to address is the actual scale of the theft of public money that happened between 2007 and 2010 relative to, so in other words, there was this theft and the trillions of dollars based on fraud committed by large banks in the United States, and then they come asking us to make cuts to the public sector services in order to pay for this theft. The logic there is complete insanity, and I just want you to address the true scale of the private sector theft, and you could invoke the LIBOR scandal if you'd like, or any number of measures of this level of thievery.
Maybe we can have both Derek and maybe Jim talk to that.
Let's start.
Well, I think, first of all, it's certainly worth revisiting how we got in this mess, and I think I sort of briefly mentioned that in my presentation, to not lose sight of the fact that we have a recession that was caused by the behavior of a privatized, deregulated financial system with vested interests who manipulated that system in a way that made us all pay. In Canada, we did have banks that were bailed out. It's a convenient myth on Bay Street that the banks were not bailed out, but those bailouts are not why we have a deficit. In fact, they were bailed out, and then they paid all the money back with interest. The government actually made money off of the bailouts here. That obviously was not the case in the U.S. and elsewhere, where banks actually collapsed and governments were left holding the bill. And that's especially unacceptable. And that's where the reference earlier that Susanna made to Iceland is interesting. Instead of bailing out the banks and then giving it back to the same people who ran them in the first place, they took over the banks, nationalized the banks, wrote off 10% of the mortgage debt of Icelanders who'd been manipulated into the thing, and then threw the former bank executives in jail. So that's one approach. So I'm in favor of trying to examine the systemic roles and factors that contributed to this, and that, and part of my conclusion, perhaps too modestly for you, about examining the failure of private business to invest their money and create the jobs and to consider alternatives to that, I think is in that vein.
I'm going to say something really unpopular, which is that I don't dispute that the banks are at the center of the story, but it's numbers like 29 trillion are bullshit. It's actually the case that in most of the, to take the U.S. example, most of those individual bank bailouts, the U.S. Treasury was paid back with interest. Not in all cases, not in cases like AIG. A lot of that number is actually, somewhat misunderstood and involves central banks taking on various toxic assets. I'm not disputing that the banks were a problem. As for the sort of premise of the question, which is basically a question about capitalism, all I have to say is please visit Eastern Europe and see what the alternative is.
Well,
all right. Okay.
Let me say something more positive to our questioners so that we all leave here happy for lunch. But I defer to Derek defer to Derek on the quantum. I just don't know. But and I'm not going to get into the 21st century critique of capitalism, though I think we need one So I think it's a good question to pose. But I do argue, I do believe that our version of capitalism is a meaner version of capitalism. And it's that mean version of capitalism, which is a combination of the financialization of the economy and the mobility of capital, has led our leaders to try to convince us that the health of the so-called job creators is more, in health, more important than the health of other people. It has constrained public policy in ways that are really damaging. And that we have to come to grips with those systemic and structural issues. We have to figure out how to regulate the financial sector. I like financial transaction taxes because they will reduce speculation and focus on the real economy. But I also take your point that we have to stop the sort of constant threat of mobile capital to give the richest few a break and to be afraid even to regulate them. So. You're not going to get your radical new Marxist tract from this panel, but you should keep asking the questions, really, at the heart of the matter.
And what you will get and what you are getting, and I think there's no question about this, is you will get much closer scrutiny. You are already getting much closer scrutiny of the financial system. It was very clear that what went on cannot be allowed to happen again. Whether that regulation will be effective is another question, but the intent of policymakers is clearly there, and as it should be.
All right. We are at the end of our time, so maybe if you have more questions, you can come up and talk to the panelists individually for a few minutes afterwards before they get to that free lunch. That concludes our session today, and I'd like to thank our panelists very much for their insight and commentary. Boy, that is quite... I was reading the bios beforehand, and that is quite the panel you've got up there. So thank you very much. Lunch is now going to be served in the room just behind you, and we'll have an opportunity to hear from Joel Westheimer, pronunciation correct, on the topic of the corporate university ascendant. So thank you very much, and thanks for inviting me.
About 5 minutes just to set up the tables back there, so don't rush. Just say nice.